Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Our Louisiana hot pepper obsession seems endless. We grow them, we eat them, and best of all, we craft them into some of the best pepper sauces on earth. Get ready for some shock and awe from the General's Hot Sauce, a great sauce for the greater good made entirely from peppers grown by Louisiana veterans. Then, award-winning nature writer Gary Nabin joins us to make the connection between hot peppers and climate change. Next, we'll cool down with hydroponic lettuces grown by Brian Bricker at Brick Wall Farms. We've got one spicy show on this week's Louisiana Eats. In 2014, Smokehouse Foods was established by a handful of veterans to launch a new product called the General's Hot Sauce. Their ultimate goal? To successfully market their product so that a meaningful percentage of profits goes directly to organizations that support troops, veterans, and their families. On a blazing hot summer morning in Washington Parish, dozens of veterans and community members gathered together in a large, non-air-conditioned building at Stony Point Farms. Hailing from all across the country, these businessmen and investors joined farmers and leaders from the area.
Hi, my name is Dan Ballister. Welcome to the first ever Smoke Hall Foods Hot Sauce Summit here at the Roper Family Farm. Smoke Hall Foods was established about a year ago to launch a hot sauce called the General's Hot Sauce. My friends and Tim and the rest of us who are investors and partners in the business sort of had two ideas working. One was that one of our friends, who is a general in the Marine Corps, is the perfect selfless leader. He's from Buffalo. He's been making buffalo wings for us for 30 years, and we felt like he deserved to have a hot sauce named after him so that he could make wings with his own hot sauce. And along the way, the business side of our brains was thinking about this idea of starting a company we could all work in together, where we could have fun, make great products that people love, and most importantly, give back to the greater good. And for us, as a company, we define that as creating jobs for as many veterans as we can, and we intend to write as large a check as we can on a very regular basis to organizations that support troops, veterans, and their families.
I'm Tim Roper. I'm owner of Stony Point Farms.
You're a handsome devil, too.
I know. I can't help that. I've been growing cayenne peppers for a long time, and I finally ran into Dan a few years back, and we'll tell you that story, which is pretty cool.
I literally Googled cayenne pepper farmer Louisiana, and I was connected to the Good Eggs website. I sent an email to their customer service people, and they forgot about me. I sent them another email a week later, and a woman from Good Eggs responded, just call Farmer Tim in Franklinton. Gave me his phone number, and I called him. He was driving across Lake Pontchartrain on the causeway. I was on a break from jury duty, and we quickly put the pieces together that he had peppers, we were both veterans, and that there was a larger, much more fun conversation to have.
Showtime. Right this way. School circle setting. We're all friends here.
Sipping on ice-cold beers and fanning themselves to keep cool, the veterans sat down to discuss their company's plan and to hear Tim explain his process for growing the peppers essential to their business's success.
First and foremost, thanks for coming, as Tim said, especially our investors, our founders, and our friends of Smoke Hall Foods. We're going to have a great day, and I can't think of a better guy to turn the show over to than Lieutenant Colonel Thomas D. Keating.
Yes.
Retired?
Retired.
Coach is going to set the stage for us.
The best part, retired. Again, to welcome everybody to the Bayou Bender. The intent behind this next 2-3 hours is just to share the story thus far. I don't know at what point everybody jumped into this thing or if they're fully in. I know my friend Jeff Hubley just recently bought into the company, and he just bought in not knowing the whole kit and caboodle. He just liked the idea behind it. Tim, we hope that you'll get up and just give us a little bit of a historical account of the farm. The whole relationship thus far has been almost like tripping into good fortune. This is all you again.
Tell the story. How'd we meet?
I'm growing cayenne peppers here a couple of years off and on, and I was selling a little bit online. And I think on the third year, maybe fourth year, I got this crazy idea that if I ferment them and spray them in the field to keep the bugs down, it kept me down. So one day, I was selling cayenne peppers online through Good Eggs, and this guy calls me and he says, "Hey, I hear you got cayenne peppers." "Yes." "I need you to overnight me about 50 pounds in New York." "Yeah, sure. Cost you." "Yeah, whatever." So he tells the story. He meets the general and they're making hot sauce, and I'm thinking, "Yeah, sure, okay. Send the peppers up there." Guy calls me back a month or two later and says, "I want 1,500 pounds. That's when he tells me the story. He's gonna make hot sauce and he's gonna do something with the wounded warriors. And I'm saying, "I'm on board, man." I said, "Yeah, take the pepper. Nobody else wants them." I've been growing them for a year. Nobody wants them. I mean, I'd sell a pound or two and I got 100 pounds.
So when we put the pieces together that he had the peppers and he would send them up, and then he proceeds to tell me that he was in the Marine Corps for over 20 years. And we sort of both had that simultaneous light bulb moment. And and as many of you recall, when we were at the Army-Navy game in 2012, we gave away 8 or 10 cases that we had made with those 50 pounds of peppers. We didn't age them. We didn't do anything. I had like 6 different kinds of vinegar, lots of trial, even more error. We came up with a decent serviceable sauce that was missing most of the key components of how we're going to make sauce. You know, no fermentation, no aging, sort of hit or miss on the ingredients. All we did was look at the labels of the 4 or 5 larger sauces out there in the world and copy it. And then one of our other investors who couldn't be here, Pete Gutierrez, aka Flaky Pete. Flaky Pete is something of a super palate, and he was our test tube, and we just kept bringing different versions of the sauce to Pete. He kept trying them, and he could actually identify each of the different sauces from other commercial providers. Then he could figure out which of ours had too much vinegar, not enough vinegar, too much garlic. And we wound up with a decent sauce. We brought it to the game, started to get phone calls in January of 13. "Hey, this is pretty good. I want more. Where can you get some? And oh, by the way, you guys should turn this into a business," which was starting to kind of come into our conversations on the side about that whole, you know, let's do some kind of work that our moms will be proud of someday. You know, I think between that trip during the Final Four in March, forming the business in June, and then sort of specking out with Tim that last summer we were going to plant about 1,000 pounds of peppers, which we did. That mash is probably still somewhere back there, right? Half of it's down here, half of it's up in New York, and that's what we're using for the samples that we'll send everybody home with. But we got off to a nice running start just in terms of having enough product to start to sing the song a little bit. That's kind of where we are today as we keep jumping through the last of these hoops. We learned a lot about fermentation. I mean, we were sort of he could see, but I was blind. But we sort of kept going back and forth on research we were doing about how long we need to age. What's going on in these containers when you put ground up peppers and salt in and just sort of let it sit for 90 days? It, you know, blows the lid off some of these mason jars, and we got a few of those that damn near exploded. I've had hot sauce in my face more than once, and mash more than twice. On the ag side, we connected with Dr. Paul Wilson at LSU last year. Tim and I went out and had dinner with him, I don't know, 6 months ago, over in Baton Rouge. And this is a guy who had been an advisor to McElhaney for 25 years. So this is a guy who knows the agricultural side of the business. I think somewhere along the way, he mentioned to Tim and me that McElhaney never took him out to dinner, but we did. And you know, he was absolutely a fountain of knowledge for us, just about. So for the most part, that's how we get to today. And if our mission today is to steal all your good ideas, have some cold beer, and also get us all sort of thinking about the same story the same way. So along the way, by the way, as you need to sort of stop, run out, do calls, whatever, a lot of employed people here, whole lot of salary in this room, as they say. Please do whatever you need to do.
The meeting went on for about an hour and a half. The veterans then broke for lunch, and we all took a tour of Tim's greenhouse, where he's growing a variety of peppers for the General's hot sauce.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've seen him on The Tonight Show. You've seen him on David Letterman. You've seen him live on the Sunset Strip. It's my honor and privilege to introduce Mr. Tim Roper.
Hi. I think if you do the math, we spent $4,000 right here putting this up. But here's the cool thing. We threw this up with just scrounged up anything we could. I put an old potbelly stove back there, started shoving wood in it, stuck a fan down there to circulate some heat. We planted peppers in here in December. Now, what I tried to do was to bring as many, because I got a lot of universities. I got Cornell, St. Mary's College, Baylor, a bunch of them wanted to come out and get involved in this. Baylor University says 97 guys at one day. So what they planted, we have all kinds of peppers in here. There's cayenne, there's bells, there's jalapenos. There's some I don't even know what they are. There's some bazillion peppers. There's some ghost peppers in here. And they planted them all like 20 minutes. But we put these in like December, January. And it has continued to throw off peppers. Right, Pam?
Yeah. What's against the wall? What's the one of those things?
I found some shade cloth at Dollar General and we stacked up there. Because when it starts getting hot here, I got to get air in here. Well, they only had two things. Pull this plastic off, but I wanted to leave it on as long as I could. Normally, we would have pulled this off a couple weeks ago, threw it off to the side, and kind of let it just grow naturally. But I wanted to leave it up. The plastic that's up here is greenhouse cover. That's the expensive stuff. All on the sides is all whatever Hunter has for paint cloth, whatever we bought over there cheap. You know, you see how it disintegrates. Yeah. The sun cooks that like in 3 days. But the sides didn't matter to me. Matter of fact, these walls aren't even really secured in. That one is because I built a table into the ground, but the rest of them are just sitting out there. And in a good storm, like yesterday, we broke a rib. This thing is moving. Man, it's going all over the place. Only because we just really didn't have any more 4x4s that we could put down the center, and that's what it needs. It needs a ridge down the center, I know that. But the trick is the square footage. I mean, and the volume of peppers you can throw out of here is phenomenal. And we've never, this technology, I didn't know anything about. We grew plants in little bitty pop-up greenhouses things and just started them and moved them out to the field. I've never actually grown in a greenhouse this big. And this kind of changes everything.
Yeah. Where were these seeds in the ground that came out? Or
we started them in trays.
No,
in trays?
In trays, yeah.
I started in trays, laid on the ground. When it got a little bigger, we just put them in the ground. Now, what we actually did was put a wire hoop in the ground, bend it over, and when it got real cold, I put plastic on top of that wire hoop. So I had a greenhouse in a greenhouse and kind of kept them going. These things, 3 months ago, I mean, you thought you were living in a jungle. They were about that much higher. It was like, I'd never seen a plant that perfect in my life.
That's Tim Roper of Stony Point Farm and members of Smokehouse Foods. For more information about the General's Hot Sauce, visit generalshotsauce.com. What is the measure of how hot a hot pepper really is? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question in 1 hot minute, so don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is the measure of how hot a hot pepper really is? The internationally recognized method of heat measure is known as the Scoville scale. Wilbur Scoville was an American pharmacist who invented this organoleptic method of testing in 1912. He dissolved dried peppers in alcohol, extracting the heat components, which was then diluted with a sugar solution before being graded by trained tasters. What a job that is! And what's the hottest of the hot peppers? Most people would answer ghost pepper, a pepper that originated in East India and was used on fences by farmers there to keep wandering elephants out of their fields. For many years, the ghost pepper was the hottest pepper on earth. But in 2013, the Carolina Reaper toppled the ghost pepper from the top of the heap. The California Reaper is a crossbreed between a ghost pepper and a red habanero. It's said to have over 2,200,000 Scoville heat units. Yikes! I'll have some milk with that, please. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Ricardo's farming roots tie him to 300 years of Louisiana tradition. Yet today, he's the last member of his family to make his living working the land. Where his ancestors once grew prized Perique tobacco, Tony's fields are filled with rare heirloom varieties from all over the world. Tony's particularly captivated by peppers. He grows over 60 varieties of them. We visited Tony at his booth at the Crescent City Farmers Market to discuss his remarkable selection. Hi, Tony. Welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Hi. How you doing? I'm doing great today.
It's so nice to see you, as always. And your market stall is filled with dazzling things I've never seen before. Tony, would you take us through each of these peppers? Because I can't get over the variety.
The ones I have today, I have a Criolla Cella. It's a real interesting pepper. It's one of the Aji peppers. It's kind of in between a cayenne, a Tabasco, and a habanero as far as the flavor. I have a Purira pepper. It's a new pepper I'm trying. It's about 1.5 times as hot as a jalapeno. And I have some squash peppers. They look like little yellow flying saucers. They have the flavor of a habanero, but they're not quite as hot. The Bulgarian carrots are pretty much exactly like a jalapeno, except they look like a little orange carrot. I have some Rio Grande peppers. There's some nice yellow and orange bright peppers that turn red. And they're about 1.25 times as hot as a jalapeno, a good thick pepper for pizza or something like that.
The white habaneros are pretty rare, aren't they?
Yeah, the white habanero is actually probably my favorite pepper. I have some shorter ones that look like little bullets, and there's some longer ones, but they taste the same. They make the best hot sauce I've ever tried.
What are some of the countries that these peppers originate from?
Well, I have a lot of different countries. I have some from Portugal. I have some Scotch bonnets from Jamaica. Fatality pepper from the Central African Republic. And really, it's pretty much endless. A lot of them come from South America.
So what is the hottest pepper that you grow?
The hottest pepper I grow is a Butte Holokia from northern India. It's the hottest pepper in the world. They're real hard. The seeds are a few dollars a seed. The oldest peppers are probably related to some of the white habaneros or the Criolla Cellas. They originate from around Brazil and Peru.
I know that you've caught the attention of a lot of New Orleans famous chefs with your flair for the unusual. Can you tell us who's doing what with your peppers on their menus?
I know Dante's Kitchen does a lot of my peppers. They have some oak barrels on the bar with little spigots and half shot glasses. Plus, they have a habanero pepper jelly that they serve with an alligator slider. I know Couchon asked me about the Criolla Cellas, and they use those. And I know Josh Smith from Amano. He gets a lot of the cherry peppers. I think they're pickling them and using them on the side of some of the dishes. Oh, yeah, and the real hot peppers actually cool you down when it's so hot the way it is right now.
I know that you left culinary school to farm full time. So what do you like to cook with your peppers?
Basically, I put them on almost anything. But like the white habaneros, I'll kind of cook them down a little bit in the oil before I make a frittata. It kind of mellows out the heat. And I make a nice frittata with that with some Mexican cheese on top and some green onions, and it's unbelievable.
That sounds delicious. Now, I know that traditionally your family used to grow Perique tobacco. What was so special about that particular kind of tobacco?
Well, Perique tobacco is a tobacco that the Indians were growing right there before the Europeans even settled the area. And I live in about a 10-mile area, where it's the only place they grow Perique tobacco, because the flavor comes out in the type of soil we have. It's, I think, one of or the most expensive tobacco you could get.
Tony, thank you for bringing such delicious flavors to us here in the city.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Tony Accardo, Crescent City Farmers Market vendor and one of the most adventurous growers I know.
Too hot. This town is too hot.
Too hot.
Too hot. Pound for pound. They say they're ruder than you.
Ethnobotanist Gary Nabin joined agroecologist Craig Kraft and chef Kurt Fries in a wild chili chase across the Americas to discover what the pepper can reveal about climate change. Gary, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
It's great to be with you, Poppy.
I don't think people would normally expect to find recipes in a book about climate change. And it was pretty surprising to me to find them there, all interspersed in with the chapters. So why did you think it was important to include those recipes?
Well, we wanted to know how weather shifts are affecting farmers, home cooks, chefs, and culture. We don't think that climate change is an issue separate from our daily lives, that it's embedded in it. And Kurt Fries, one of my two co-authors, listened to the farmers and home cooks and chefs that we visited and asked them for their family recipes and their cultural favorites. And he put these in to remind us that if climate change is happening and affecting the availability of our favorite peppers, then it has an effect on what we'll have on our kitchen tables. So we felt that unless we made that cultural connection, that climate change isn't something separate from our own lives and our own cultural community, that people might dismiss it.
You came to Acadiana to ponder the relationship between Tabasco peppers, our Cajun culture, and the changes along the Gulf Coast. So what did you learn here?
Well, first of all, I want to say the changes in Acadiana or Cajun country are not all due or primarily due to climate change. We know that we're losing a lot of the lands in southern Louisiana, but that's not due to ocean level rising at this point. It's due to the subsidence that's happening and the inroads that storms are making along all the pipeline right-of-ways and other points of access. So it's a very complex story, and we don't want people to believe that we're saying that climate change is driving the access and use of peppers in Louisiana. What we did learn, though, is that you have the McElhenney Corporation that's one of the most sophisticated companies in the United States working with agricultural products in terms of adapting to climate risks, not just long-term climate change, but the way it's changing its operation to be more sustainable and spreading out its production areas so that one storm can't knock out all the Tabasco peppers that are being produced. And there's a sophistication there in looking at minimizing risk to provide people a food as memorable and iconic and notorious as Tabasco. So the McElhenney Company is about one of the best examples of how people can positively adapt rather than be victims of climate events.
What do you see as the greatest threat to Louisiana's Tabasco pepper?
I believe that it's our disconnection as a society to our agricultural producers. there's less than 3,000 acres of cayennes and other hot peppers produced in Louisiana today. That's far less than the cayenne and Tabasco production that you had historically. So that most Tabasco production in Louisiana is just in a few experimental and seed plots on Avery Island. In most cases, we're getting our peppers from Latin America rather than our own homelands. And that means that if we're going to rely on other countries for our chilies, we need to have good relations with the farmers there, just like we do in our own backyard.
I was lucky enough to be along on that trip to Avery Island that you all took. And one of the things that really struck me is that Tabasco is still a local product, because not only is it made here, but the seeds all are cultivated on Avery Island and then shipped to these other places in the country. So it's not really a big disconnect in the way you would think with having all these other countries growing the peppers, huh?
Well, I completely agree with you. And the other components of that story that are so fascinating to me is that all the Tabasco sauce in the world, whether the peppers are grown in Louisiana or not, use the salt from the salt domes on Avery Island. They're all fermented in these oak barrels on the island. All the seeds that go out to some dozen or so places each year come back to be processed completely on Avery Island with Avery Island salt and the old barrels and the old recipe. So there's sort of a timelessness about Tabasco. I think it's a model how other place-based foods can be protected from adversity, whether it's the hurricanes and floods you all have suffered or other factors. The McElhenney Company has come through year after year in producing a quality product that has something that connects with our own taste memory in much the same way from year to year.
Well, despite the normally bleak outlook on climate change, at the conclusion of your chili chase, you offered some great hope. Would you tell us, how do you believe that we can counter climate change?
Well, there's still uncertainty about the rate of climate change and severity of the impacts, but there's no doubt anymore that we're experiencing weather shifts. And so the one thing that we need to do is remember that farming and producing and using food in a way that is both sustainable and dignified and honors our traditions is something we should have been doing all along, whether climate change happens or not. So supporting the kinds of farmers who are doing it right is the first and foremost the thing that we should be doing. Second of all, the scientists need to learn to listen to the farmers about what they feel they can do and that we can all do about climate change. They're out there observing the weather every day. And so rather than this purely being a topic that I think science should drive, I think we ought to listen to the people in our food system who are bearing the brunt of extreme storms and catastrophic weather events and take their lead and bring them in as models and heroes of this, rather than thinking that they're trivial to what we should do. And third, I think your line about eating it to save it, that the way to keep rare foods alive in this world and on our plates is by celebrating their unique qualities and making sure that as consumers, we never let those foods go away.
Gary, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us again on Louisiana Eats, and please come back soon, okay? Chili Chaser, Dr. Gary Navin. One of my favorite dinners since childhood is stuffed bell peppers. There are lots of different ways to stuff a pepper, but my favorite version is the one I remember from my great-grandmother's dinner table. Unfortunately, Mama didn't write down any of her recipes, so I had to recreate them through trial and error with my daddy, her grandson, judging the accuracy of my efforts. It seems that now the love of bell peppers has been transferred to the next generation, as my daughter Maddie called me the other day to ask for the recipe. Since I wrote it down for her, I thought I'd share it with you all. Cut the crowns off of the peppers first and chop them finely. Then, clean and halve the peppers before blanching them in salted boiling water for a few minutes until they're tender. If you stuff a raw bell pepper, the stuffing will dry out before the pepper's tender. Next, brown some ground beef and add the chopped pepper crowns, an onion, and some celery until those seasoning vegetables turn translucent. Add some diced shrimp, stirring the mixture together until the shrimp turn pink. Then, moisten some stale French bread with water and stir it into the meat mixture. Add about 4 tablespoons of Worcestershire sauce with some fresh chopped parsley and green onions. Season it to taste with salt and pepper, and then generously fill each pepper half with the stuffing. Sprinkle on some breadcrumbs, and of course, top each one with a generous pat of butter. At this point, you can freeze your peppers for a super fast, easy supper in the future, but if it were me, I'd eat them right now. The peppers bake in a 325-degree oven for about 25 minutes or so, just until they're nicely browned. Just talking about these peppers is making me hungry. For a copy of this recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org and at itsneworleans.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and my stuffed peppers make for some good Louisiana Eats. When we come back from a short break, we'll visit one of the most innovative young farmers I've ever met, Mississippi's Brian Bricker of Brick Wall Farms. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats roving reporter Jill Benson always knows where to stop for the next delicious meal. Jill, where's our next stop?
We're going to the Dinner Bell in Macomb, Mississippi, Poppy. You hear the tolling of the dinner bell from miles away, and it's been ringing since 1945.
My gosh.
Kind of easy to just drive by, but you'll know you're on top of it because there's always a line out the door. The dinner bells open Tuesday through Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. There are 3 large dining rooms, and each room is occupied by a gigantic round table. Each round table is covered by a large Lazy Susan. So service here is boarding house style.
Like family style.
It's family style. Except typically you don't sit at your dinner table and spin a thing around.
No.
You just wish you could.
So what's on the spinning table?
What's on the spinning Lazy Susan? Okay, well, I was talking to one of the cooks at the dinner bell, and she assures me that she starts work every day at 3 a.m., and I believe this, seeing what's coming out of that kitchen. As the Lazy Susan rolls by, you take what you want from the table, and when a bowl just starts to look a little empty, out comes another lady from the kitchen to replace it. The house specialty is fried eggplant, which is fried perfectly crisp and graceless, and it's delicious. But there are so many things to choose from. There's rich, silky chicken and dumplings, spinach casserole with cream cheese and artichoke hearts. There are sweet potato casseroles, fried chicken, more chicken and dumplings, stuffed peppers, towering cakes, flaky pies. It's
wow.
It's crazy.
So what is it? A pay one price, all you can eat?
Well, Tuesday through Thursday, $12. Friday and Saturday, $14. Sunday dinner, $15.
Oh, my gosh.
But children under 10, half price.
Well, it sounds really delicious, and it also sounds like a slice of something from the past that's truly almost disappeared.
Absolutely, Poppy. I've never seen anything like the dinner bell.
Well, I think I hear that bell ringing, so let's go.
Let's go, Poppy.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Jill Benson. It was last fall at the Crescent City Farmers Market that I first saw Brian Bricker's hydroponic lettuce. His market table was simply breathtaking, covered with luscious lettuces of several varieties, each so perfect they looked like edible green bouquets. Cultivated at Brickwell Farms in Pass Christian, Mississippi, Brian's lettuces are entirely grown hydroponically using strict organic methods. We visited Brian at his farm to learn about this fascinating process from seed to harvest.
So this is our seedling room. It's where the seeds begin, and its purpose is to recreate the darkness in the earth.
It's very cool, yes. And it's pretty dark in here.
This is where we plant the seeds, and we let them germinate. We get nearly 99% germination, which is significantly over what you would normally see in, say, a ground crop system. So we start over here with Oasis cubes. It's the medium I use. That's what we plant the seeds in.
And what is an Oasis cube?
The long and the short of it is, it's basically an inert rock. You want to use something inert. You don't want any additives or anything. And you want it to be a sponge. You want it to soak up water. So I use Oasis, is a company brand name. There is Rockwool, you can even use sand, you can use demineralized rock. And so you plant the seeds into these cubes over here.
Okay. And it's such a clean environment. It's spotless in here. There's no dirt at all.
No, no dirt at all. Actually, you want to keep dirt out of a hydroponic system. In dirt, you have something called Pythia, and in addition to several other microbes and whatnot. But Pythia is one of your main ones that you want to keep out of a hydroponic system, so you have to keep it clean.
So you've got this little brick that's about maybe half the size of an ice cube, and it's got a hole in it. And so to plant, you just put the seed right in that hole?
Yes, Poppy. And then it germinates in about a day and a half. And so then it's ready to go over to the greenhouse, because then it needs sunlight.
Okay. Well, let's go see the greenhouse. Oh, it is so beautiful in your greenhouse. Oh, it's even better than finding you at the farmer's market, honestly. It's gorgeous in here. It's clean, and everywhere there are these beautiful, beautiful growing heads of lettuce. What happens once you get that sprouted lettuce in here?
Well, we take it over to the propagation table. My hydroponic system has three steps: propagation, nursery, and then finishing. So propagation is where it just starts off. You can see here's 1 week, another week, and the first week goes from a single seed to something with two or four leaves on it, quarter of an inch tall, to something with a dozen leaves on it when it'll move over. And if it's a head type lettuce, we'll move it immediately. If it's a leaf type lettuce, we'll leave it for a bit longer till it's about a foot tall.
Describe these racks for me. What did you build here?
So my system is called an NFT system, nutrient film technique. There are several systems of hydroponics. There's Dutch bucket, ebb and flow, there's a raft system. I chose this one because it is the primary one you want to use for lettuce. NFT works well for lettuce because it has a large amount of leaf area and a very shallow root system. If I pull this plant out, you can see it has very small roots, very little roots compared to the leaf area. I have what's called a recirculatory constant flow system, which means that it pumps, the water pumps up from a tank up to these pipes on the front here through the tubes into the channel and then flows down gravity fed from there to the back and then flows down back to the tank. So it all goes in a loop. There's no runoff. There's no any real contaminants outside of this system. I don't have to worry about anything anywhere else, just what's in the system. And everywhere else doesn't have to worry about what's in the system here, because even the most helpful nutrients in large quantities in your river systems, anything else, can be detrimental. So we go from here at the propagation table over to the nursery, and as you can see, they'll be about an inch tall when we move them in a few days. When they get over here, they're, I don't know, four times the size. The better you get a hydroponic system, you can get roughly an exponential growth, which means that it'll be a squared bigger on volume every time. Now, that doesn't always work out in practice. That's more theory, but that's what we hope to achieve here eventually.
There's so much concern, and you hear so much talk about water. And the people who are really in the know, I think, realize that the most valuable asset on Earth is water. And it's something that we don't have enough of, and it's going to be a continuing problem going into the future. What is your water uptake like? How often does it get replenished? And can you compare that to conventional farming?
Actually, you can. Though I do have to put a little bit of water in each night. That way I keep it topped off. With a closed lid and a recirculatory system like this, you can actually keep your evaporation rates very low. And since I'm not draining any water off of a field, I keep my water usage very low. Maybe 50 gallons in a given month.
And 50 gallons produces roughly how many heads of lettuce?
I do 750 heads a week, so we're talking 3,000 a month.
Out of 50 gallons of water, that is a true magic trick. Tell me about the harvest. So you've grown up these heads of lettuce to head size from teeny, teeny, weeny, and it takes how long?
About 6 weeks as it stands, though I hope to cut that time down.
And what's the harvest like?
Harvest is actually fairly straightforward. Unlike a ground harvest where you harvest stuff kneeling down, everything's at waist height. I simply pull a channel off and I pull it over to this table and I harvest from there into a bin.
So what have you got growing here, Brian?
So I typically have 13 types of lettuce and arugula as it stands right now. I've grown basil, I've grown greens, all work wonderfully. So right over here we have our red oak leaf. The red oak leaf is a very strong flavored lettuce. Reds are always stronger than greens. So you have these are going to be crunchier. And then you have your red Chicago butters over here, which are the ones that look like flowers. And they're going to be a tenderer leaf, but very similar in flavor. So then we move farther on and we got our green oak leaf, which are a crunchier, lighter flavor. But the red is healthier for you, though. It's more nutritious. It's a little stronger in the flavor for that reason, but it's more nutritious. Then you have our green Chicago butter, which is our best seller. And this is the one that will turn into a flower first and foremost before anything else. And it forms these little bowls when they're young, and then these turn into the heads you see over here. And they are an absolutely spectacular plant.
Incredible. And then what is this beautiful frilly thing?
So these are endive, varying kinds of endive. You have your incised and your sweet crisp, and I have red and greens of both. Each leaf of endive is like a leaf of lettuce, but without any of the in-between parts. It's only the big veins, the crunchy bits. And it's a wonderful head of lettuce. It's very crunchy, more flavorful than the oak leaf is, but less so than the butter.
Is your endive a little bitter? Does it have a little bitter edge to it?
That depends on how you grow it. I can grow it to have more bitter. I can grow it to be lighter. I can grow it to be crunchier.
How do you make the plant do what you want it to do like that?
You control airflow. You control the nutrients. You control the acidity. You control water flow. It all makes a difference. And that's one thing we hope to do this summer, is employ a number of new methods to cooling the greenhouse. As Poppy, I...
it's hot in here.
Yes. It's actually it's about 95 right now, and it's going to start pushing 100 pretty soon. But it's also 98% humidity.
Well, we'll come back and take some pictures once the plants are getting a little breeze from the fan. Okay. Lovely breeze.
So, we're out in the cleaning station right now. So the channels that you saw in there, as you said, dead plant matter, leaves that started off very young, got trapped underneath, didn't get any sunlight, so the plant cuts them off. And so that's fine. We clean that off, but some of it is left on the channels that they grow in. And we take those channels out here and we clean them, wash them down, and take them back inside to be used on the next week. And we move 750 heads every week, so we have to pull the channels. And there's only 18 spots per channel, so we have to move some channels in and out.
Amazing. So the way that you were growing these, is it considered organic?
Yes and no. I cannot, the last rule that I really have on my organic certification, and I have to go through the states and the federal to finally get it, but I need 7 years of production.
So how difficult was it with the state and the county getting this operation rolling?
So it was both easy and difficult, because their code is built on a need and necessity. And well, since nobody had ever brought it up, I mean, they brought up building a greenhouse and building stuff like that, but once I put a concrete floor in there, once I put a solid foundation, it became a permanent building, a whole different animal. And so it did take about 8 months to get everything sorted out, going to the code office, going to the mayor's office, going to Jackson, going here and yonder to figure out what it's classified as, because they didn't even know what to call it. There's no designation for this, there's no nothing. And so we made stuff up and we wrote it down, and it's in the new book and it's all set up.
So you literally are the hydroponic lettuce pioneer of Mississippi, huh?
As far as I know.
Brian, I want to thank you so much for giving us a tour of your beautiful, inspiring hydroponic farm here. And stay in touch with us. I can't wait to see you the next time at the farmer's market.
Well, thank you, Poppy, and it was a pleasure to have you out here.
Brian Bricker of Brickwall Farms. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Join us on Thursday, August 27th at the Rouse's Culinary Innovation Center at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, when Times-Picayune food writers Judy Walker and Marcel Bienvenu help host our first Louisiana Eats and Cooks Club. To commemorate the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, Judy and Marcel's Cooking Up a Storm is being reissued in a special hardcover edition. We'll be cooking up a storm with Judy and Marcel, and eating up a storm, too. Brady's Wine Warehouse will provide the wine pairings. What a night this is going to be. You'll find the link for tickets on the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's website at southernfood.org and on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week as we visit Pesh Seafood Grill, where Chef Ryan Pruitt works with South American live fire.
But just seeing how you're able to use so many different levels, from the slow cooking to high heat searing to everything in between, was just completely new and different.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans French Quarter. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studio at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.